You think you're having a hard time finding a COVID test? Well, try looking for a nurse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, December 28th. Good to have you with us. The CDC's move to shorten isolation times for asymptomatic COVID cases is getting some mixed reviews. But those in support of the change are hoping it will help alleviate staffing shortages in many industries. This has been a particular problem at American hospitals. Many were short of workers even before the pandemic caused an exodus of doctors and nurses from the field. Now, the more transmissible Omicron variant is sending some of those remaining workers home. Marketplace's Savannah Maher reports hospitals are running out of backup plans, particularly in rural areas.
Vermont was already in dire need of healthcare workers, even before the pandemic sent many of them into early retirement and other careers. That's according to Jeff Thiemann with the Vermont Association of Hospitals.
Our workforce is shrinking and stressed at a time when we need it to be growing and resilient.
In New Mexico, more than half of hospitals face critical staffing shortages.
The amount of physical, mental, emotional fatigue is showing.
Deborah Walker with the New Mexico Nurses Association says many providers have left the state's overwhelmed rural hospitals on traveling nurse contracts.
To pay off student loans and to command a higher salary.
With the national shortage of healthcare workers, small rural hospitals are having a hard time hiring, says Joanne Spetz with the Institute of Health Policy Studies at UC San Francisco.
Just because of their locations, their financial situations are often more precarious.
And with the rise of Omicron and many rural communities' low vaccination rates.
You're looking at potentially a large number of people coming into the small hospital and possibly having staff out sick.
That can mean rural patients wind up traveling hundreds of miles for care. Christine Porter is a professor of public health with the University of Wyoming.
The chances of finding that next hospital and in time if it's an emergency will be decreasing. It's a great time to not need a hospital.
She says the state's healthcare workforce is bracing for Omicron. I'm Savannah Maher for Marketplace.
Omicron's rapid spread serves as a reminder that big disparities remain in global access to COVID vaccines. The University of Oxford says in the world's poorest nations, just 4% of people have received a first dose, compared with 70% of people in the wealthiest countries like the U.S. Health experts say that lack of equal access has contributed to the rise of new variants like Omicron. Now, some large company shareholders are stepping in to exert pressure on vaccine makers to turn the tide. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
Few pharmaceutical companies have come under as much scrutiny as Moderna, which, like other companies, got considerable U.S. government help in developing its vaccine.
So given that the public is underwriting the risk, what kind of considerations are they taking as they develop their access strategy?
That's Meg Jones-Montero of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. That coalition of 300 socially minded investor groups is demanding more information on how much Moderna charges per vaccine in low-income countries. It's reportedly shipping far fewer doses to those nations than other vaccine makers.
If you're saying it costs this much money to develop a drug, then be transparent about it and disaggregate that. And as investors, let us know what is the real cost.
The United Kingdom's largest asset manager, Legal & General, has taken that pressure campaign up a notch with its own shareholder proposal demanding transparency. Moderna did not respond to Marketplace's request for comment, but recently told the SEC it has been transparent about the pricing of sales to the U.S. government and will provide more details by mid-February. Wharton Assistant Professor Rob Hughes says the debate gets into murky ethical territory.
Pharmaceutical companies are ethically required to make life-saving drugs available to people who need them. That doesn't mean that they need to operate as charities.
Hugh says governments and NGOs also have a role to play in ensuring vaccine equity around the globe. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, there were some mixed feelings today. Oh, about everything. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. home prices are up in much of the country again. Great if you're trying to sell a house, not so much if you're trying to buy. In October, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller U.S. National Home Price Index, that's a mouthful, was up just over 19% compared to the same time a year ago. But the pace of that growth has been slowing down a little bit over the past few months. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on that.
The Case-Shiller report found that price gains in October were smaller than in September, and September's price gains were smaller than in August.
I feel like the frenzy from buyers is pausing a little bit.
Matthew Hilton is a real estate agent in the Tampa Bay area of Florida. To be clear, he says the market in his area is still very competitive, but Hilton thinks people are less willing to get into bidding wars.
Just because I think there's so many buyers out there that have been looking for so long now, they're a little frustrated with, you know, having to waive all their contingencies and go well over list price.
Any sign of a slowdown is welcome news, says Mark Fleming, chief economist at First American.
That's a good sign for the housing market. That's healthy to have less appreciation at the moment.
Home buying typically slows down at this time of year, says realtor Celinda Rebo, who's also based near Tampa. She says when things pick up again next year,
I think we're going to start seeing a little bit of a cool down.
Especially if mortgage rates go up. The question, she says, is whether housing inventory will grow to meet demand. She says there's hope there, too, at least in her area.
The last couple of years, anywhere there's any little pocket of land, new home builders have started buying those up.
That said, new construction only accounts for 10% of home sales in the U.S., so more existing homes will have to come onto the market to have a real impact on prices. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Circling back to our healthcare theme from the top of the show, the pandemic has also exacerbated the country's opioid crisis. Overdoses soared 29% nationwide over the past year to a record high of about 100,000 deaths. California is pouring millions of dollars into a new program to help treat people who are at risk, and it's becoming a model for the rest of the country. Leslie McClurg visited a hospital in Oakland where caregivers and doctors are racing to get people into treatment.
A stream of patients rolls off ambulances at Highland Hospital. Inside the ER, nurses dart between beds. Christian Halosian is reviewing the chart of a recent arrival.
Patient presents with mild opioid and benzo withdrawal symptoms, irritability, tremors, sweating, last used fentanyl, crack cocaine.
Halosian is a substance use navigator. His position is relatively new at Highland. It's funded through a statewide program called California Bridge. His job is to help people who do drugs navigate the healthcare system.
Just letting them know, we got you. We're going to try and do the most for you right now.
He can help with everything from getting someone signed up for insurance to connecting them to a treatment facility.
We'll go see this patient in room 17. Knock, knock. Hi. Are you okay?
A woman in her 60s named Sonia slowly pushes herself up onto her elbows. We're not using her last name because of the stigma around addiction. She's sweating profusely.
So you started getting nauseous and you started having a runny nose.
Yeah, I just want... I've been sick throwing up out of both ends.
Sonia says she blacked out playing bingo the night before.
Withdrawal symptoms, opioid withdrawal symptoms, classic.
And then an ER doc peeks in to give Sonia a low dose of buprenorphine. The small white pills are one of three federally approved drugs to ease withdrawal symptoms and cravings for a day or two. Sonia brightens up almost immediately. And then Halosian schedules her for a follow-up appointment.
And that's our number right there.
Okay.
Medically assisted treatment is a key California Bridge tactic and part of a statewide push to make it more widely available.
It lowers mortality risk by about 50%.
That's Monish Ulal. He's an internal medicine doctor at Highland and a substance use expert.
There's very little in medicine that has that big of an impact on a person's chances of dying.
Studies show that patients who receive opioid meds in the ER are twice as likely to remain in treatment a month later compared to someone who doesn't. But only about 20% of ER docs in the U.S. are adequately trained to dispense them. Some patients and doctors are skeptical about an opioid alternative.
Patients will ask, how long am I going to stay on this medication? How soon can I get off? And then doctors are asking, too, aren't you just replacing one drug for another? They're stuck on the buprenorphine, too.
But Dr. Ulal argues that lots of diseases require lifelong medications, like high cholesterol. He says addiction is a brain disease that requires specific medication, too. Here at Highland, doctors dispense opioid dependency meds on demand. Halozian checks in on a patient in the hospital's treatment clinic.
Why'd you come here today? What can we help you with?
My sobriety, you know,
okay.
So to get clean, basically just to get off of heroin and meth.
Drew is 36 years old and he lives on the streets. We're only using his first name because of his illegal drug use. He often lands in the ER after an overdose.
This is methadone.
A doctor delivers Drew a couple of blue pills.
It doesn't taste good at all.
How important would you say that medication is to staying off drugs or to your treatment?
To be honest with you, no. I would have definitely stayed using drugs.
Drew's eyes roll back as the methadone starts to hit. He says today is a success because he didn't shoot heroin. The state invested $20 million into California Bridge last fall to expand the model. Now about 40% of hospitals are enrolled. The state's goal is to increase that tally to 100% by 2025. In Oakland, I'm Leslie McClurg for Marketplace. Coming up,
sold for $50,000.
Ill-gotten gains from a booming trade, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 95 points, a little over 0.25%, to close at 36,398. The Nasdaq gave up 89 points, a little over 0.5%, to end at 15,781. And the S&P 500 dropped 4 points, 0.1%, to finish at 4,786. Another number, 89. That's how many cruise ships the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's keeping an eye on because of COVID outbreaks on board. Some of the companies whose vessels are on the list: Carnival fell 0.2%, Walt Disney added almost 1.6%, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings fell 1%, and Royal Caribbean Cruises gave up a little over 0.25%. Shares in Moderna, which Lily Jamali was just telling us about, fell 2.2%. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.48%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. We talked a bit yesterday about growth in the gaming industry, helped in large part by pandemic lockdowns and people looking for some escape from reality. The same kind of holds true for streaming. I can't begin to tell you the number of shows, mostly anime, I binged this year, and many of us spent a lot more time and money on our streaming services in 2021. According to Leichtman Research Group, 80% of U.S. households had a paid streaming video on demand subscription. But will this momentum carry into the new year? Katie Keck is a staff writer at The Verge who covers streaming and entertainment. Katie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So recap for me how streaming services fared in 2021.
Well, streaming services did exceptionally well during the pandemic. Viewership was up across the board. You know, with so much uncertainty around COVID, streaming sort of offered this short-term solution for entertainment in ways that other things that we normally do in our day-to-day lives could not. So, you know, especially as we've seen more and more films that were intended for theatrical, you know, debuting on streaming services instead.
With so many people streaming so much content right now, there is such competition for people's time and eyeballs. How have you seen these various platforms and content producers adjusting to that in the pandemic?
Sure. Well, content is king. If you want people to spend time on your service, an investment in original programming is absolutely essential. You know, Netflix and streaming services operate in a way where they're not just competing with each other. They're very much competing with literally any other thing that we could be doing, whether that's sleeping or taking a walk around the block or playing video games. I mean, all of these extra hours in our day, that's what they're really fighting for, is peak engagement, you know, so to speak. Original programming is really the hook.
Deloitte says in 2022, at least 150 million streaming service subscriptions are going to get canceled worldwide. How do those cancellations factor into this ongoing competition landscape in the streaming world?
Well, one of the things that industry sort of experts are theorizing is that there is far too much choice right now. There are too many services. So we're likely going to see sort of your Warner Media Discovery type deals happening more and more, or these services are simply going to shut down because it's not sustainable for legacy media companies to be throwing millions and millions of dollars at a streaming service that is not retaining and not attracting subscribers when they're competing with the Netflixes and the Disney Pluses and, you know, the Hulus. These companies are just too big. So, you know, most people will likely have a core streaming service and then, you know, like a Netflix or a Disney Plus, and then, you know, maybe one or two others, but none of us are going to subscribe to every streaming service moving forward. I mean, it's just not tenable.
And real quick, how many streaming services do you subscribe to?
Entirely too many. probably at least a couple dozen. But
it's for work. It's for work.
But it's for work. Yeah. And I have to regularly sort of reconnect with everyone and make sure that my subscription has not lapsed. But yes, it's for work.
Katie Keck covers streaming and entertainment for Verge. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
While we're at it, we want to know about the stories that shaped the way you thought about the economy, whether you stream them or listen live. Take the Marketplace year-end poll at marketplace.org. It's been almost a year since the UK quit the European Union, and the nation still split over whether it was a good move. Supporters boast the country can now make its own decisions on issues like trade and regulation. Opponents say Brexit is to blame for labor shortages and supply disruptions, just like they predicted. But what hardly anyone predicted was that Brexit would amplify a long-standing problem of the UK being something of a hub for trading looted antiquities, often snatched from war-torn countries like Syria and Iraq. From our European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The most infamous recent example of a looted artifact was handed back to Iraq at this repatriation ceremony in Washington in the fall. A 3,500-year-old inscribed clay tablet, the Gilgamesh Dream Tablet. It was pillaged from an Iraqi museum during the first Gulf War. It may have been seized and returned by the US, but as Assistant Attorney General Kenneth Polite pointed out, the stolen tablet first surfaced in London.
You see, the tablet turned up in the UK in 2001. It was smuggled to the US and sold for $50,000.
And this priceless object was eventually sold for $1.6 million before it was seized. The fact that it was trafficked in London doesn't cause much surprise on this side of the pond.
For various reasons, London has been an important center in this trade.
Archaeologist Mark Alterweil of University College London, he says the trade in looted artefacts, especially lower profile items like coins, mosaics and jewellery, has boomed in the British capital.
Because it's a very much a global city, so it's a key point in which traders and others have come to. Many people have connections to other parts of the world.
And he believes the laws banning the importation of stolen artefacts are not enforced rigorously enough in Britain. Brexit makes matters worse, says Fionnuala Rogers of Blue Shield UK, a group dedicated to protecting cultural property. She says the UK recently repealed a key piece of EU legislation that cracked down on this illicit trade.
Now that the UK has left the EU and the EU's brought in much stronger legislation, the UK is going to be vulnerable because our legislation is much weaker comparatively.
Unlike the EU, the UK now doesn't require an import licence for any antiquity brought into the country. And you have to know the item is illegal before you can be prosecuted here.
The problem of having Europe with one much stricter piece of legislation and the UK with essentially nothing comparable, it automatically makes the UK a gateway.
That gateway for looted artefacts is likely to get wider, says archaeologist Neil Brody, since the EU is likely to enact further measures aimed at discouraging this illicit trade. Two of the key member states demand nothing less.
The European Union includes countries such as Italy and Greece, which historically have been subject to quite heavy looting and the theft of their cultural objects, their antiquities.
Indeed, the Greeks recently stepped up their long campaign for the return of the greater part of the Parthenon's marble frieze, which they claim the UK stole in the early 1800s and which now resides in the British Museum. The Brits, says Brody, seem to have a bit of a blind spot when it comes to the trade in looted artefacts.
We have a history in a way of benefiting from it, both culturally and financially. So the urgency isn't there, really, or the impetus isn't there to act against it in the way that the Europeans will.
In a statement, the British government said, "We believe that existing UK law is sufficient to combat this illicit trade." But the campaign to toughen up the British measures goes on, not only because this trade has financed terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but, say the campaigners, because it undermines the cultural cohesion and identity of war-torn countries and further hobbles their chances of recovery. The very point made at that artefact repatriation ceremony in Washington in the fall by the Iraqi Minister of Culture, Hassan Nazim. Returning Iraqi artefacts means restoring Iraq's self-esteem, he said. It means restoring Iraq's confidence. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
this final note on the way out, the big launch of the James Webb Space Telescope may be behind us. The rocket took off Christmas Day, but there are many, many more steps ahead before the Hubble replacement is up and running. Today, it started the beginning of the really hard part. See, the telescope, with its giant mirrors and tennis court-sized sun shields, was too big to fit in even the biggest rocket on the way up, so it was folded up for the ride. Now, over the next 2 weeks, it will slowly unfold in space with no way to provide tech support if something gets seriously stuck. And given almost $10 billion went into making sure this thing works, the stakes are pretty high. Okay, we gotta go, but first, your moment of economic context. More on that healthcare worker shortage Savannah was talking about earlier. According to the American Nurses Association, by next year, there will be more jobs for RNs than basically any other profession. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts we'll need 1.1 million new nurses to keep the existing shortage from getting worse. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Nguyen, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.